Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
Just a quick note before we begin. This is a great moment of fear and unrest in the United States. This episode was recorded several weeks ago, and we hope it offers you at least a small space to find respite. From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Sometimes when you go through a bad breakup, the only thing you want is answers. Why didn't things work out? When did it go from good to bad? What went wrong? Well, Brian Getty took an unusual approach to getting those answers. He writes about the experience in his essay, Researching Jenna, Discovering Myself. It's read by Hassan Minhaj. Hassan's Netflix show is Patriot Act with Hassan Minhaj, and it's releasing new episodes now.
Why do you think Jenna left me? I asked friends and family, pen and paper in hand. I admit it looked silly, and it felt silly too. But my psychotherapist had urged me to start writing down my conversations with people about what had happened with Jenna, instead of, as she put it, just letting the wheels spin. And I had decided to follow her advice. Enough with the endless whimpering. Time for some hard-nosed research. Of course, I also hoped I might find an answer. I certainly wasn't having much luck staring at my ceiling night after night, sleepless and distraught. And Jenna had proved to be a poor source of information since she had stopped returning my calls. I didn't think any of my interviewees knew Jenna better than I did. She and I had been together almost 10 years. But still, there was a Jenna I didn't know. Namely, the Jenna who left me so suddenly over the phone that warm afternoon in March. This Jenna, I hypothesized, must be the composite of the imaginings of all these other people. Flipping open my stenopad, I first posed my question to a friend of mine with whom I had quickly started an affair after Jenna left. She was in her kitchen, perched on a stool, smoking a Marlboro in her green bathrobe. "Oh, Brian," she said. "Why do you want to torture yourself?" "It's not torture," I said. "It'll be good for me." "Is it something about beating a dead horse?" I urged her to say something. She and Jenna didn't like each other too much, but I had always felt they were a lot alike. My rebound lover took a drag on her cigarette and said, "I think it has to do with the age difference between when you started out and now. You were 19 when you got together. Over time, she developed needs and desires, needs that maybe she didn't even know she was having. And whether or not she told you about these needs, you weren't fulfilling them." Scribbling down her thoughts, I tried to think of a good follow-up question, as a good researcher would do, but I realized I had been hoping she'd say something more like, "I don't know, I don't care, let's mess around." Instead, she had concluded that Jenna left because of my inadequacy. And did this mean she, too, was anticipating my inadequacy? Suddenly hurt, I ended the interview. Next, I asked Cynthia, Jenna's favorite professor in college, who had become a good friend of us both. It was at a party. She wore a colorful blouse that looked like it had been shredded and sewn back together. I pulled her onto the front porch so we could be alone for my interview. "She left you for her own reasons," Cynthia said. "I think she had a lot of small unhappinesses, the most recent being that she felt unsupported when her dad died. She felt he abandoned her, and she decided that you abandoned her too. She had a big catharsis, and you were a part of that." She looked away from me. "I also think she wanted someone to stand up to her and fight her more. That's probably projection. That's why I leave men. They don't stand up to me. I winced at the thought that in Cynthia's mind I was no better than her two ex-husbands. But she was right, I think, about Jenna's dad who died suddenly 4 months earlier. This wasn't the father who raised her, but the estranged, alcoholic, misanthropic father whom her mother had left when Jenna was two, taking Jenna with her. When he died, Jenna was visibly upset but soon stopped talking about it. They weren't close, Jenna would say, adding that it was more of a relief to her that he was in a better place. The subject of his death didn't come up again until she called me to say that losing her father had turned her whole world upside down, and that I was no longer in it. I figured I needed to take my research deeper, closer to her family. So my next interview was with Jenna's stepfather, Tom. When I asked him why he thought Jenna had left me, he said simply, "I don't know." We were standing on the sidewalk in front of my house. He had stopped by after work to pick up some things Jenna had left behind and didn't want to retrieve herself. Artwork, books, printmaking supplies. I stood there waiting, pen to paper, until he said again, "I don't know." "I don't know, I don't know," I repeated, writing it down. I shouldn't have mocked him. Tom had been consoling to me in the past, but today his rushed and dismissive response irked me. I looked up from my notepad and said, "That's it?" "I'm probably going to answer every question like that," he replied. I started to write that down too. "Probably answer every question like that." "We've all been in relationships," he finally interrupted, "and we all know that no one around you knows the answer." He paused as I wrote silently. "And the corollary is, no two people in any relationship know what's going on in that relationship." This seemed very wise to me, and I told him so. I'd always liked Tom. But as we put Jenna's stuff in his car, his statement lingered between us and became extremely troubling to me. In rapid succession, I wondered about my relationship with Jenna, about his relationship with Jenna, and about my relationship with him. Before Tom drove off, we shook hands and wished each other well. The way things had been going with Jenna before she left me, I thought he and I were on the path to becoming in-laws. Now we were nothing. This much we could know for sure. My mother was the last person I needed to speak with for my research project. And that requires some background information. When I was 8 years old, my mother divorced my father and left us in Seattle, moving across the country to start a new life. For 2 years, I was an emotional wreck, but finally, I got on with the business of growing up. I saw her Christmases and summers, got along great with her new family in Virginia, and fit in perfectly with my new stepfamily in Seattle. I never resolved my feelings about my mother leaving, but I decided they would be unresolvable. Look, everyone's got issues with parents, I decided. Life isn't fair, deal with it. In my first visit to a psychotherapist after Jenna left, while I was in my spinning out of control phase, my deft counselor identified this trauma deep in my emotional life. And I erupted first with tears, and then with an overwhelming clarity. I was having, I realized, the same reactions I had had as an 8-year-old. Grief-stricken, lying awake at night, wondering why she had left, wanting to do anything to get her back. I wrote my mother, telling her of my realizations, and she told me it was high time to pay me a visit to work some things out. Weeks later, over our steak and salad dinners in the restaurant next to her hotel, my mother told me what it was like for her to leave me, my sister, and my father. She talked about how necessary it was for her to rebuild herself, how it was a decision she hated having made, but the life she was living was something she had hated more. I was surprised to feel uninterested in these monologues. For so many years, I had wondered why she left, but now I realize I didn't so much care. The point for me was that she had. All I actually needed was to tell her that her leaving had really screwed me up for a really long time. She looked up from her plate and nodded. I didn't get to ask my mother why she thought Jenna left me until I was driving her back to the airport 2 days later. I handed her my notepad and pen and told her about my research. You want me to write down what I think? She said incredulously. Yes, I told her. It was part of my psychotherapy. She was quiet for a moment and then she wrote, she had too much pressure. Master's degree and family of origin problems. Communication broke down because of pressure. She stopped writing and spoke out loud about how you can't have too much pressure from family issues if you're going to have a successful relationship. You have to really sweep the floor, she said. It was all a part of being on the ball, not only in your relationship, but in your life. But you'll see, she said, in your next relationship, you'll have learned. I glanced at my dashboard. The low gas light was on. Damn. I tried to remember how many miles it was to the airport. I pictured trying to flag down a cab on the highway as my mother missed her plane. Damn. At the next exit, I apologized and pulled off the highway. That's fine, my mother said, waving off my apology. But when I got back in the car after pumping gas, the first thing she said was, never let it get below a quarter tank. Okay, Mom. Maybe you're not quite ready for that next relationship, she said, laughing. I laughed too, but it stung. Okay, Mom, I said. And she was right about me, of course, but not because I'd failed to maintain at least a quarter of tank of gas in the car. It wasn't about that. Just as her talk about sweeping the floor wasn't about Jenna and her father, but about me and her. Just as the friends I had interviewed had been talking less about us than about themselves. And just as my research hadn't led to the discovery of a Jenna I didn't know, but of a me I didn't know how to approach. When we arrived at the airport, I walked my mother into the terminal and hugged her goodbye. Then I returned to my car and my life, content this time, to be left behind.
That's Hassan Minhaj reading Brian Getty's essay, Researching Jenna, Discovering Myself. We'll catch up with Brian after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Brian Getty's essay was published 15 years ago in 2005. He says he reached out to Jenna before the essay was published.
That's the last contact that I've had with her. Yeah, in 15 plus years. But I hope she's doing well. If I do run into her, I hope, you know, we can have a good conversation. You know, I know very little about her life after this, but I've certainly had a lot happen in my life after that. And I hope we can catch up on amicable terms.
Just a few weeks before his Modern Love essay was published, Brian met Emily, the woman he eventually married.
We've been married now 12 years. We'll have our 13th anniversary coming up. We have three kids, 12 and 8 and 3 years old, and a very happy, busy family life. But back then, we were newly dating. And so I told her that this is this crazy thing. This piece is going to come out in the Times. Oh, my God. So we celebrated. We took the article to this bar in Iowa City called George's and toasted with whiskeys. It was a really happy memory. Though, all the while, thinking it's a little awkward, maybe, that like she's starting to date this guy who's been through this and then is now writing about it in the newspaper. But it didn't stop her.
These days, during the COVID-19 outbreak, Emily, Brian, and their kids have been doing movie nights, playing basketball together, and balancing homeschooling and working from home. And Brian says that in some ways, it's been a good experience.
There's been a lot of stress with the quarantine situation. But one of the great things has been how much time we spend with each other now. As the kids get older, as well they should, they spend a lot of time in with activities and with friends, and all that's fantastic. But we're like in this capsule now with each other. And I think at the end of all of this, we can look back at this time as being a pretty special one.
Brian also says that unconventional as it may be, he does recommend conducting interviews after a breakup.
It worked for me in a lot of ways. It definitely was kind of goofy and awkward to put people on the spot in ways. And it also made me feel bad and awkward, and people would say things that I wouldn't want to hear. But that's good in the long run, too. So, yeah, I guess I would recommend it. It helps to get the insights from others so that you may be better able to read the writing on the wall.
That's Brian Getty. He's a professor of writing and literature at the Community College of Philadelphia. We should also say that we reached out to Jenna, but she decided not to participate in this episode. More from Daniel Jones and Hassan Minhaj after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones. He's the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
What I loved about Brian's essay was how it begins with this rational dissection of his relationship and this sort of investigation into what could have possibly gone wrong, and how it takes him just further and further into himself and into this emotional reckoning with a sense of abandonment and with his mother and these sort of deep, you know, hurts that affect us throughout life, but you don't really realize it until you do the work to get there. It was such a moving essay in that sense, but it also had a light touch to it. And I particularly liked, you know, his relationship with his mother at the end, which is the fraught relationship that drove him all along, but ends in this sort of sweet place where she's sort of making fun of him for not realizing that they're running out of gas. And they have a little laugh about that. It sort of releases you from the essay in a nice way where it had led to sort of this painful spot. But there was still room in that relationship to be able to smile and laugh and sort of share a warm moment.
And here's Hasan Minhaj on why he chose to read this story.
As a comedian, we're in our heads so much. And we always flesh out all these narratives about our relationships with other people. And this story really stuck out to me because I'm a person who really lives in his head.
Thanks to Hasan for recording this week's essay at home in a closet at 8 o'clock at night. His Netflix series is Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj, and it's releasing new episodes now. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. We're edited by Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional thanks to Mia Lee, Julia Simon, and Anya Stremian at The New York Times, and to Michael Garth at WBUR. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.